I mentioned on Sunday, after doing a one-off message entitled, Is the Bible Reliable? I mentioned in one of the early points as I was giving seven reasons that we can trust the Bible, I mentioned how we have internal consistency as one of our reasons for being able to trust in the reliability of Scripture. And I had mentioned specifically about how we see all of these thousands of cross-references and how this is profound, knowing the fact that the Bible consists of 66 books written by over 40 authors over a span of 1,500 years in three continents, in three different languages, and then with all of that being a unified, consistent story without contradiction. And then I did mention that how, though I make this claim, there are those who will say, well, wait, I thought I've heard that the Bible is full of contradictions. And I had said at that point, well, if you are someone that's heard that before, or if you've ever been interested in that topic, well, I wanted to invite you to come this evening, because what we're going to do is we're going to just look at some of these supposed Bible contradictions. And I think that it's once again going to show you that the Bible can be trusted, and that even when we look at these supposed or apparent contradictions, you're going to notice that typically when you look at the context and whenever you are able to come with an open mind to the text, I think you'll actually see that none of these are blatant or even clear contradictions. But before we go right into some of these examples this evening, I do want to give some helpful disclaimers up front. And the first one is, if not obvious, is not every supposed contradiction is going to be covered this evening, right? I'm not going to be going through every single possible contradiction that an atheist or a skeptic may bring to you. And in fact, I don't even know if I could do that, because there's always a new one that someone could say plausibly this may be a contradiction. But rather, I'm hoping to give you just a wide variety of different types that are going to go from the beginning of the Bible to the gospel accounts, and also different types of maybe potential supposed contradictions. So they're not always the exact type of how you would harmonize or reconcile them. So hopefully you get a healthy idea of what some of these examples may be like. But one thing I would encourage, though, is if you ever do find someone that's like, hey, the Bible is full of contradictions, rather than just having them list them off to you, ask them, give me your best example. Give me the one that you think is the best example of a contradiction in the Bible. So then rather than trying to just chase down every potential one that they bring up, you say, give me your best. We'll look at that one. And if we can reconcile that one, then most likely then these other ones probably also can be reconciled and harmonized. And so I want us to maybe think about it in that sense, because whenever I come and gave, I'm going to come and present 10 of these tonight. Some might be thinking, well, I don't feel like that's the best one, right? There might be a skeptic that listens to this later and is like, well, he didn't give the one that I thought was the best. And the hard part about deciding which ones to give is that really the ranking of difficulty is subjective in some ways, right? Some Bible passages that might be hard for me to reconcile and figure out how it's not a contradiction might be really easy for you. And there might be some that you really stumble over. And for me, it's like, oh, that's not hard or difficult at all for me. Right? So as I am presenting 10 of these tonight, I hope that you will recognize that I'm trying to just give you what I think are some very well-known, common, some common objections to the Scriptures. And hopefully it gives you a fair experience of what some of these would look like and what they would be like. And as we look tonight to these specifically, I think it's so important that we recognize that context is always crucial in trying to discern and understand what these passages are teaching and saying. And that is historical context, that's cultural context, and biblical context, like what is actually going on in the genre and the way that the literature is working and being used. And then one final thing, as a helpful disclaimer, is to remind ourselves that differences and or uncertainty does not mean contradiction. That is to say that there may be differences in the text. Like when we look at some of the gospel accounts, you're going to notice that they don't say things the exact same way. And they will say things that other gospel writers do not say. But just because there is a difference, that doesn't mean that it's a contradiction. In fact, many would argue that for eyewitnesses to give an accurate account is you're going to notice that they're not going to say the same thing. If you had multiple people all witnessing a car crash and then they were to give their account of what happened, they're going to be from different sides of the road. They're going to see different things. Maybe one person's going to notice someone in a car. They're going to mention the color of a car. Maybe in another example, they might mention the direction of the car. So the thing is, just because there's a difference, that doesn't necessitate a contradiction. Likewise, uncertainty. If I present you some solutions tonight for some of these supposed contradictions and you're like, I'm still not really convinced on that. Or maybe you're thinking of another contradiction that I don't cover tonight. And if we have some time, maybe we'll be able to look at a couple others if someone has any on their mind. But just because you aren't able to reconcile it immediately, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a contradiction. There could be cases in which we might not know what the best answer is, but it could still very well have a logical or historical explanation that we just haven't found or come to understand yet. And in fact, there's many scholars that literally do this for a living, and they're looking at these and answering these objections regularly. So, with all that being said, let's jump in, and I'm going to share with you tonight 10 common supposed Bible contradictions. Answering the question, does the Bible contradict itself? And so, the first one we're going to be looking at is the creation accounts, specifically the Genesis 1 and the Genesis 2 creation accounts, because there's some who make the claim that in Genesis 1, specifically in verses 24 to 26, it gives us a certain order of how things were created. And then they argue that in Genesis 2, in verses 19 to 20, it seems to change the order up, in which they're thinking, well, clearly this is a contradiction. So let's read these. Genesis chapter 1, verses 24 to 26. It says, "Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So this is in Genesis chapter 1, we've been seeing this chronological order of events, right? The day 1, day 2, and right here where we're reading verses 24 to 26, this is day 6. And on day 6, it says that God creates all of these living creatures according to their kinds, and he mentions some of them, right? The cattle, these creeping things on the earth. And he says, and then after that, God says, let us make man in our image. And then he creates man and then specifically gives them the charge to have dominion over these creatures that were created, right? So you see the animals are created, then you see that man is created. But then we look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 19 to 20. It says, "Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him." So the supposed contradiction is asking, was humanity created after the animals on the sixth day or before the animals? Because what they would argue is that the very beginning of in chapter 2, verse 19, it says, "Out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam." And so some are trying to say, well, see, look, Adam already existed. He was already created on the sixth day. And then it says, but God is now bringing these creatures out of the ground and then bringing them to Adam for him to name. So is there a difference in order here? Is God contradicting himself, or is the author contradicting himself? Well, I don't think that we have to view this as a contradiction, because I think what's going on is, first, Genesis 1 is providing us a broad overview of creation in a structured sequence of days, right? It's telling you literally what happens after the next thing. It's really focused on the order of things. But then when we come to chapter 2 of Genesis, the focus is not on the different days and the order of animals than man, but rather what it's focusing in on specifically is what happened with the creation of humans in the garden. And in fact, if you even look in chapter 2, it even specifically says that this is when Adam was created and he's putting this man in the garden. And so what I think is being described here is not the animals didn't already, or, you know, God didn't not create the animals yet, but rather this is what's going on in the garden specifically. That God creates Adam, places him in a garden, and then he starts to create these things in the Garden of Eden specifically. And he puts them in front of Adam and gives him the ability to name them and show dominion over them. Another possibility, if you're like, well, no, I feel like that's not exactly what it's getting at here. You also notice that in verse 19 of chapter 2, it says, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam. Notice the past tense there. It could also just be saying clearly that the ground, out of the ground, these things were formed, and then God brought them to Adam later when Adam was created. Either way, I don't think that it's a problem. It could be that God was doing a unique creation thing in the garden on the sixth day with Adam, because God can do multiple miracles in one day. It's not impossible that he would be able to, and in fact, we even see that in the Garden of Eden, right? We see he creates these plants and these trees, but then he also makes a very specific garden that is unique from the rest of the world. So he could do that with the plants. He could do that with the animals. One other thing to think about with this specifically is this is not two different books that are being written about these two accounts. This is the same book, Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2. The author is not schizophrenic. He didn't forget what he wrote in chapter 1, and then he's like, what was the order again? We'll just say this now, right? So it's one thing if you have two different authors writing and maybe they're contradicting each other, but surely you wouldn't think that they are contradicting themselves when they are trying to give you the understanding of the creation story. It seems very well that he was giving you first the order of days, and then he's zooming in on the specific day, what happened with Adam and Eve in the garden. And I think that that's a easy way to find a solution and reconcile that text. Number two, God is not a man. In Numbers 23, verse 19, it says, God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? So here in this text, you know, from Numbers, we see that the author, which is likely Moses, is saying that God is not a man, and it even says he's not a son of man, which that's another term and title that we've heard in the New Testament specifically referred to for Christ, right? And it's saying God isn't a man, and he's not a son of man. But then, when we come to John's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 1, and then I'm going to read verse 14. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So, contradiction, is God a man or not? Because Numbers says, God is not a man, he's not a son of man, and now it's saying that God became a man, and it says that he's the son of the Father, and we know Jesus uses the phrase or the term, he is the son of man, right? So, once again, is this a contradiction here? And we do have different authors now writing, so we have Moses and we have John writing. Once again, I don't think so. I think we see here, what is Moses in the book of Numbers, what is he emphasizing in this passage? Well, he's saying that God is not like man in terms of moral failings, like lying or needing to repent, because he literally says that. He says, God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. So he's saying he's not like humans in the sense of their sinfulness, right? God is holy. And so I think what he's getting at in this is that he's showing that God has an unchanging, perfect nature. That his nature does not change, that it's not sinful. But I don't think Moses is trying to make a claim that God is limited and he doesn't have the ability to take a human form. That's very different. You notice the claim there? He's saying God's not like man because man in one sense is a fallen nature. He sins. He needs to repent. He lies. He's saying God's not like that. But do we think that Moses doesn't think that God is able to take human form? Because once again, did not Moses write Genesis? And is in the book of Genesis not the story where Abraham meets Yahweh, who came and took a human form and was literally talking with him and two other angel witnesses with him? So there were three visitors there. So Moses wrote that, and we know that there's other accounts where it says like Jacob wrestled with God, right? And it wasn't like a divine spiritual being, it was like a physical form. And so I don't think that Moses is trying to say anything about God's capability about taking human form. In fact, Moses even met God in the burning bush, which was a temporal location. It was a very specific place that God was dwelling in and being present in. So I don't think Moses was even trying to comment on the incarnation or the impossibility of the incarnation. And then whenever we think about what John 1 is saying about Jesus and the incarnation, is that he's saying that Jesus became a man without ceasing to be God. Thus, he maintains this unchanging essence and nature of his divinity. Right? Jesus never stops being divine. That unchanging, immutable nature of holiness and perfection, that is always there. What he does is he takes on himself an additional nature, the human nature. And so we have both a divine nature and a human nature in the person of Jesus Christ. And so I think that when you understand the Christian doctrine of the incarnation, and you understand the context and the intention of Moses in the book of Numbers, I don't think that we see a contradiction that God is not a man, but he is a man. I think rather it makes sense of what both authors are intending to convey. Moving to number 3, we see the genealogy of Jesus. So the genealogy of Jesus, we actually have two genealogies. We have one in Matthew chapter 1. And we have another in Luke chapter 3. And if you're familiar at all with these, you'll notice that they have some differences, some discrepancies here. And if we were to read it all, you'd see that there's actually a lot of differences, but there's some that we can zero in on specifically that I think will draw the tension a little bit for us the most. So in Matthew chapter 1, verse 16, it says, "And Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ." So who is Joseph's father in this text? Jacob. Now, when we go to Luke 3, verse 23, it says, "Now Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being as was supposed." 30 years of age, being as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli. So, in Luke's account, who is the father of Joseph? Heli. So now, you notice that, okay, it says Jacob is Joseph's father in one, Heli is the father of Joseph in another. So, what's going on here? And so what the contradiction is claiming is Matthew and Luke are giving different genealogies of Jesus, particularly in terms of the names of his ancestors, where Matthew's giving Joseph his father as Jacob, but Luke is giving Joseph's father as Heli. And then another one that you could notice is in Matthew 1:6, compared to Luke 3, verse 31, where Matthew traces the line through David's son, Solomon, while Luke traces the line through David's son, Nathan. And so you actually, from David's root there, they both agree David is in Jesus' genealogy, but one goes through Solomon, which is the kingly line, and another one goes through Nathan. And so you see that there, and they're thinking, okay, so you have different names for Joseph's father, and you have different lines from the root of David here. So is this a contradiction? once again, I think that we have good reason to believe that there are other options on the table. The Bible doesn't tell us 100% why there are different genealogies, but we also want to be careful and understand that Matthew and Luke most likely knew of one another's gospel accounts. We know that Luke specifically was getting and receiving as many eyewitness testimonies and documents as he was making his gospel. And so it's very likely that he would have known what Matthew was writing and what genealogy he was using. But what I think you can do is when you look at these two genealogies is when you think about Matthew, and I actually preached on this not that long ago, so maybe some of you are familiar with this. Matthew, I think, is tracing the legal line of Jesus through Joseph, his adoptive father. And it even mentions, by the way, and I really emphasize this in verse 16 of chapter 1 of Matthew, it says, and Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary. And I mentioned that it's really interesting that Matthew wanted to be clear that it's Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus. Basically, the author's like wanting you to know that Jesus didn't physically, biologically come from Joseph, but rather he is the husband of Mary, who is the one that begot Jesus. And so it's in one sense that it seems as if that's what he's wanting you to understand in his genealogy, is that Jesus has the legal right claim to the Davidic throne because he really is adopted by Joseph, but he's not biologically related to Joseph. And then when you flip to the other genealogy in Luke, what he's doing is tracing the biological line through Mary specifically. And that would then make sense why there would be a break with David's line, where Nathan would be the one that would lead to Mary, and Solomon is the one that leads to Joseph. But you might still ask the question, well, wait, but it says that it's the father of Joseph when we're talking about Jacob and Heli. Well, it's very likely that what we're doing here is we're referencing Joseph because typically they would use the males in the genealogies, and because Joseph married Mary, his father-in-law could very well be Heli. So that would be Mary's father. And so they're just using Joseph as the name there. And if you even notice in the verse that I read to you in Luke 3:23, it says, being, and then in parentheses here, as was supposed, the son of Joseph. Right? So once again, wanting to be very clear here that this person doesn't think that they were biologically created and a descendant of Joseph. Right? It was supposed in the culture. People thought, well, yeah, of course Mary and Joseph had a son and it was Jesus. So it's funny that Matthew and Luke both kind of make a qualifier right there when it's coming to the birth and the birth of Jesus. And so I think it's very well, it could just be simply saying that we're tracing two genealogies. Matthew is following Joseph, and then Luke is following Mary, and he just uses Joseph's name because he's the male, and that's typically what you do in genealogies, and people that would have known that relationship would have been able to understand the distinction. But if you don't like that, there is another option that Eusebius, an early church father, brings up as a potential. And what he thinks is that Matthew is tracing the biological line, and Luke is taking into account an occurrence of what is called the levirate marriage. And what this is talking about is that there are times in which there will be a male who is married to a woman, and he will die before ever having a child. And then what the brother of that male is responsible for doing is to marry that woman and then to have a child so that that family line will continue. And so there are some arguments out there that are thinking, well, maybe there was some deaths there where one genealogy is mentioning a specific name, but the other one is considering the names of those who have passed away, and so that line is still continuing in that way. We also want to understand that there are different purposes in the author's genealogies. If you notice that with Matthew's gospel, it starts with Abraham, and it goes all the way to Jesus. Whereas Luke starts with Jesus and goes all the way back to Adam. And so in one sense, I think it makes sense if we take the first view about the legal line of David and the other line being the biological line from Mary, is that Matthew's intention is wanting you to see Jesus as the Messiah, as the Christ, which is a very Jewish concept. But then Luke is known for being focused on the whole world. And specifically, he addresses women a lot. And so the fact that he traces Jesus all the way back to Adam is maybe showing how he is the Son of God and he is the Son for all of humanity, which would make sense if that was his intention there. And then Mary being his actual biological descendant or his biological mother, you would see how it's encompassing women in all of humanity. And so you see even their genre and the author's intention throughout the entire gospel fits with that view and that theory there. So either way, I think that we don't see that it's clearly a contradiction. There's a lot of things that can happen with genealogies. And on top of all of that, genealogies we know can extend and collapse depending on how people write their genealogies. Not every time are they writing every single person. They write notable people. And in fact, we even notice in Matthew's account, he takes certain sections of 14 intentionally. Like he's wanting to have a specific method so people could remember these genealogical names. So either way, I think that we see that this isn't clearly a contradiction in the text. Moving to number four, staffs and sandals. This is referring to when Jesus sends some of his disciples out two by two to go on a mission trip. And in Mark chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, Mark chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, this is what Jesus says. He commanded them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bag, no bread, no copper in their money belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. Okay, so just to kind of clarify once again, so he's commanding them to go on this journey, and he says that he doesn't want them to take anything on this journey, and he says, except a staff, so they can take like a staff, a walking stick. And then it says, but there's no, you can't take a bag, that'd be like a money bag, or money belt, or no copper in the money belt, and no bread, so no extra food, right? You're supposed to be pretty much dependent on God. And it says, but to wear sandals, so you can wear the sandals, but you're not to put on two tunics. Like, you're not supposed to, like, double layer yourself as you go out into the elements. So the two things that Mark says that they can take with them, if you notice, a staff, and they can wear their sandals. Now when we move to Matthew's account of the same mission trip, it seems, Matthew chapter 10, verses 9 and 10, Jesus says, provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belts, nor bag for your journey, nor two tunics, nor sandals, nor staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food. Now this one, for me at least, on the surface, that looks kind of bad, right? You're like, okay, Mark says, don't take all of these things, except you can have a staff, and you can wear your sandals, right? But then this one, it's basically saying like, provide none of these things. And it even says, nor sandals, nor staffs. But this is why it's important to know Greek and Hebrew, or at least to utilize tools that can help you read these things. And I think that this actually gives us a better understanding of what each author is wanting to convey. Because once again, the assumption here is that the contradiction is asking the question, were the disciples permitted to take staves and sandals on their mission trip, or were they not, right? But when you look at Matthew, in the Greek word that Matthew uses specifically, so in the English translation, the word is provide there, right? If you have a New King James. Some of your other translations like ESV will kind of already give you a better hint, I think. But in Matthew, it uses the Greek word, which is kataomai. And kataomai literally means to procure or to acquire. Now, when you look at Mark's account, he doesn't use the same word, but rather he uses the Greek word, iro, and that's still probably not right anyway. But what that word means is simply to take. Now, you might be thinking, well, that doesn't make much of a difference. Well, it really does if you think about it for a second. What is the difference between me taking what I have with me right now or going to procure and acquire something before the mission trip? There is a difference there, right? You can go with what you have, and you're not going to acquire anything else, or you could go and acquire some other things that you don't have already. And I think that that's actually maybe the distinction that's being made here. is that the disciples were not to go and acquire additional staves or sandals or any of these other things that are mentioned, but to use the ones that they already had. So if there were some disciples that were getting this commission to go, and some of them already had their staves, well, you can go and take those. But you're not to go and get all these extra things, including an extra pair of sandals or go and get staves. Rather, I think that the stress here is the urgency of the mission. He's saying, I want you just to go. So like right now, there's some of you that have coats maybe. Some of you didn't get a coat. But if I commissioned you and say, hey, we're all going right now to Carbondale to do some outreach. Now, I might say, don't go grab some extra coats. Because they'll be like, oh, I should have grabbed my coat. Nope, you can't go grab your coats. But I'm not saying to the people that have coats here, you have to leave your coats, right? So I think that that could be a very easy way to understand this, especially whenever they're not trying to stress and saying very clearly, like, no, I'm going against what Mark was saying here, or I'm going against what Matthew was saying. I think that it just makes sense depending on what they're trying to stress here. And once again, I think Mark is saying clearly they can take what they have with them, but they're not to go and get extra. And then Matthew is just very clearly saying, don't go grab extra things and acquire them. So I think that hopefully, like I said, there might be other options on the table, but I think that that, for me, gives me peace in understanding that text. I think it makes sense to me, especially when you look at the specific Greek words being used. Number five, looking at the relationship between Jesus and the Father. And this is going to come in, both of these are going to be found in John, the book of John. John chapter 10, verses 30 to 33. I and my Father are one. Then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, many good works I have shown you from my Father. For which of those works do you stone me? The Jews answered him, saying, for a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, and because you, being a man, make yourself God. So Jesus here is claiming divinity, and he's claiming to be equal with the Father, of equal status. He says, I and my Father are one, and that's the very specific reasons that they're wanting to stone him and kill him. It's a claim of blasphemy there that they're declaring. But then we go to John 14:28. It says, you have heard me say to you, I am going away and coming back to you. If you loved me, you would rejoice because I said, I am going to the Father, for my Father is greater than I. So, the contradiction potentially is Jesus equal to the Father, or is the Father greater than Jesus? Right? Is he equal, or is the Father greater? And I think, once again, it's important that we notice this is written by the same author. Once again, is John being schizophrenic here? Did he forget what he wrote down earlier? I don't think that's likely. So why don't we try to read John and the Bible in context? And I think that when we see what Jesus is talking about in each of these examples, is that they are discussing different aspects of the Trinity. Each passage is giving us different information in aspects of what we understand God to be when we understand and claim that he is a triune being. So there's something that is referred to as the immanent Trinity, and there's another thing that's called the economic Trinity. The immanent Trinity is referring to God's eternal, unchanging, perfect nature, right? That is who God is before the world began. You know, before anything was existent, before God was interacting with humans, or before there was any need for redemption, what was God like in his nature? That's the immanent or the ontological Trinity. Then there's something that's referred to as the economic Trinity. And this is how God in his personhood, right, in the three persons, how do they relate and interact with one another and with the world now that creation exists and the fall has occurred? So how does God in these three persons interact in the roles for redemptive history? And I think what we see here then is that what Jesus is showing us is that the Father and the Son are equal in the first category, in their divinity, in the immanent Trinity. They're equal when it comes to their nature, but they're different in their roles within the plan of salvation. That is, Jesus, as the second person of the Trinity, is eternally equal, co-equal with the Father. But whenever he became incarnate, he took the form of a servant. He chose willingly to submit himself to the will of the Father to go and suffer and to die on a cross. And so we see clearly the Father didn't come and die on the cross. It was the Son, the second person of the Trinity. So we see that there's different roles given to these individuals. And I think that this is what it's actually showing us here. It's showing that there's a difference between their ontological status and then their redemptive roles. And so the doctrine of the Trinity is teaching us that Jesus is truly God, equal to the Father in essence, but distinct in his role and function. And just maybe hopefully give you a couple of real practical examples of this so you're not thinking of just getting so theological that I'm trying to argue my way away from the contradiction. We see this in a lot of different relationships today. So think about your marital relationships. We believe, as Bible-believing Christians, that men and women are both made in the image of God. They're equal in value, worth, and dignity, right? In their nature, who they are as human beings, are equal. However, we would also say that the husbands are called to the leadership role in the home, and that the wives are called to submit and to trust the leadership of their husbands, right? So there is a hierarchy that is put in the home. That doesn't mean that women are lesser than men, but it does show that there's distinct roles given in the home. Or maybe you don't like that example for whatever reason. This also happens in your occupational relationships. In one sense, we would say that your boss is greater than you because they make the big decisions. They get more money given to them, right? Because they have to make the big decisions. They have to hire people, fire people. And if you're just a new person that just got hired on, well, you're not less human than them. But you would still, in one sense, say their role is greater than me. And so I think, likewise, that's what Jesus is saying here, is that Jesus, as the second person of the Trinity, is not lesser than God the Father. But in role, as he takes the suffering servant and he is submitting to the will of the Father, he willingly takes on a lesser role in redemptive history. And so I think that is what Jesus means by saying that the Father is greater than him in that passage. I don't think that at all, if you understand Christian doctrine at all, I don't think that there's a contradiction in that. Moving then to number 6. We see the death of Judas. Now, this is an argument that I heard recently on a debate by Bart Ehrman. Now, Bart Ehrman is a well-known New Testament critic. So he's a scholar in the field of the New Testament, and he is not a believer by any means. And he uses this as a good argument, he thinks, of a biblical contradiction. And you can find these in Matthew 27, verse 5. And the other one is going to be in the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 18. But Matthew 27, verse 5, it says, "Then he," that is Judas, "threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." Okay? So how did Judas die? He went and he hung himself, right? But then we go to the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 18. It says, "Now this man," this is Judas, "purchased a field with the wages of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his entrails gushed out." And so that's all we get in Acts about the death of Judas. So did Judas hang himself, or did he fall headlong and burst open? Is that a contradiction? Well, I don't think so. And I think if you think about it, even for a little bit, it almost seems laughable to not see how it clearly can be reconciled here. But clearly, I think what we see is that Judas hung himself, and later, his body fell, the rope could have snapped, the branch could have broke, and then because of his body hanging for a period of time, was probably ready to rupture whenever it made contact with some rocks below, or if he was hung over a cliff, it very well could have been that he hit a branch or another stone or a part of the cliff that made him tip and go headlong, where eventually whenever he hits the ground, he obviously bursts open. And, you know, I think it's even more apparent because what if we just took Acts chapter 1 for a second and we didn't even know about Matthew and we're trying to say, no, Acts' account is correct. Well, how many people do you know that when you trip and fall headlong, you just burst open? Like if you're just walking in the field and you just trip and you're like, whoa, you don't just burst open, right? It makes more sense when you think, oh, because he was hanging, his body was decaying, becoming weaker, and then whether it was he was cut down, the rope snapped, or the tree branch broke, and then something allowed him to tip over, and of course then he would, it would make sense that he fell and he burst open. It makes perfect sense because you fell from a height that you were hanging. It doesn't really seem to be a big issue at all. And so I think the two accounts are describing different stages of the same event. One is focusing on the initial act, hanging, and the other is on the result, falling and bursting open. Moving to number 7, the timing of Jesus' crucifixion. Are there different timing or times given for when Jesus actually was being crucified? In Mark 15, verse 25, it says, "Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him." So when was Jesus crucified? The third hour. Okay? Moving to John's Gospel, chapter 19, verse 14, "Now it was the preparation day of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, 'Behold your king.'" Okay? So now what we're seeing is in Mark's account, he's crucified the third hour, but in John's account, it's the sixth hour, and he's still standing trial before Pontius Pilate. So was Jesus crucified at the third hour, which, by the way, that would be 9 a.m., or was he still standing trial before Pilate at the sixth hour, which would be noon? Is that a contradiction? Well, I think if you know a little bit about the ancient world, you would know that there were different ways of recording time in the ancient world. And in fact, in the third hour in the Jewish system, that would be the, let's see if I'm getting this right. In the Jewish system, the day started at sunrise, right? So that would be around 6 a.m. Of course, they didn't have watches, but that would be relatively around the time. So if their Jewish day started at 6 a.m., what would be the third hour? That would be around 9 a.m. And so if Mark is using the Jewish time table, time scheduling, then it would say that he was crucified around 9 a.m. But then if you look at John, who was writing primarily to Greek-speaking and Roman-influenced individuals, it would make sense that he would be writing in the Roman time system. And if he were writing in the Roman time system, where the day started at midnight, like we would, that's how we record it, right? The beginning of the new day is at midnight, rather than sunrise, what that would mean if it was the sixth hour, that would be 6 a.m. And so John then would be saying that Jesus was standing before Pilate early in the morning, as soon as they could get Pilate's attention at 6 a.m., that's whenever Jesus was there. And then in Mark's account, he's saying, but he was crucified later in the day at 9 a.m. So, once again, if you have these two different ways that time is being counted, which we know that they were in Jewish context and Roman context, and we know that John was writing to Gentile Roman context, it could make sense that that's who he was addressing. So we see here, once again, a possible solution to an apparent contradiction. Moving to number 8, we see the sign on the cross. And I'm not going to read all of them for you, but I'll just tell you the references quickly. Matthew 27, verse 37. Mark 15, verse 26. Luke 23, verse 38. And John 19:19. The question is, what did the sign on Jesus' cross actually say? Because in these accounts, they seem to be different. Was it, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews"? The King of the Jews? "This is the King of the Jews"? Or "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews"? Now, some of you immediately see that and you're just like, really, this is a contradiction that they're seeing here? But I think that it's really not that hard to answer for a couple of reasons. One is, first, we notice that in one account, it actually even says that these were written, in Luke's gospel, it says that the letters were written in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. So that seems as if there were actually three different writings of a similar message or the same message. And we know that when you translate something, it's not always a word-for-word correlation. And so it's very possible that what did the sign say? It could have said all of these things, just slightly nuanced, because there's different languages being written up there. However, there's a more simplistic way in understanding that in the ancient world, they didn't use quotation marks like we do. They weren't always, you know, they don't have quotes and capitalization and lowercase, how we would typically do it. Typically, what they would be going for is the central message of the sign. And so if they were not trying to give you a literally word-for-word correlation of what the sign was meaning, but they were just wanting you to understand, this is teaching that they were saying this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Even that, I didn't say the exact same one of any of these. It's the same message. If I were to ask a typical Christian, what did the sign say? You might not even say the exact of any of these. You might give a paraphrase that is conveying the exact same message. The point is that what was written on the sign is that there's Jesus of Nazareth, and he is the King of the Jews. So I don't think that this is one that we need to be that concerned about either. Moving to number 9. The number of angels at Jesus' tomb. In Mark 16, verses 5 to 6, Mark 16, 5 to 6, and entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a long white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." So we see here that there's this young man sitting in the tomb, and he is wearing these white garments, white robe, and he tells them about Jesus being resurrected. But then when you go to John 20, verses 11 and 12, it says, "But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain." And so, were there two angels at the tomb, or was there only one? And in the one, it sounds like it says it's a young man instead. Is this a contradiction? Once again, I don't think so. The presence of two angels is not in conflict with the mention of one. You might be telling a story and just be focusing in on one specific individual. And here, I think Mark is probably focusing on the angel who spoke and was describing that he looked like a young man wearing garments, because angels, we know, took the form of human beings. And so it's very possible that Mark was focusing on the angel who spoke, where John was wanting you just to know all the angels who were present. And I think that this is a really common thing, because you see this in other biblical examples. The Gadarene demoniacs, one account says there's one guy there, another mentions that there's two demoniacs. Also, when it comes to the resurrection accounts, some mention specific women, where others mention other women, or just zero in on Mary Magdalene specifically. And I even have a perfect practical example where I just experienced this with my grandmother the other day. She was watching my kids for me so I could go do a Christian podcast, and one day I was talking to her, and I said that I was going, and Aiden Brown had a podcast, and I was going to go on it and speak there. And then another day, we were talking about the same podcast, and I was saying, yeah, actually, Cade, my cousin, knows one of the guys on the podcast and was doing some Bible studies with him, and she's like, "Aiden," and I said, "No, Hayden Taylor." And she's like, "Wait, I thought you said it was Aiden Brown." And I was like, "Oh yeah, well they both do a podcast together." See, I'm the same person talking to the same person in a different conversation, and at one point I was talking about Aiden, and the other one I was talking about Hayden. And you can even see how similar the names are. You might thinking, "Oh, did I make a mistake?" No, it's just depending on the conversation that we were having in the context. It doesn't mean that there wasn't two guys there running a podcast. So I think that, once again, it's a perfect example that just because one mentions a certain number, it doesn't conflict with the other. And then finally, moving to number 10, how much time did Jesus spend in the tomb? Because when we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it seems like they give different numbers or different information. In Matthew 12, verse 40, it says, "For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." So Matthew says, how long is Jesus going to be in the tomb? 3 days and 3 nights. Mark 9, verse 31 says, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." So one is saying 3 days and 3 nights. One is just saying after 3 days. And then Luke 24, verse 46 says, "Then he said to them, thus it is written, and thus it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead the third day." And so how long was Jesus in the tomb? Was it after 3 days and 3 nights? Was it just after 3 days? Or was it on the third day, which wouldn't be after 3 days and 3 nights? So is there a contradiction here? Well, the phrase 3 days and 3 nights, if you even look at some other biblical passages, you'll notice it's a Jewish idiomatic expression that is commonly used and doesn't necessarily mean actually 72 hours, right? Three full 24-hour periods. Rather, it's just meaning to count parts of the days, and you could utilize that same phrase. And in fact, in the Jewish world at this time, any part of a day could be and would commonly be counted as a complete day when discussing a time period. And so if you had any part of one day somewhere doing something, then it would be counted a full day. So like if you fasted for an hour today, and then you fasted for 3 hours tomorrow, and then you fasted for just an hour the next day, you could say, I've been fasting for 3 days, right? And now you probably wouldn't want to do that and say, I've been fasting three full days or something like that, or 3 days and three nights. But that is kind of like the parallel of ways that it could be described. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, that seems weird that he would use this language if it was just part of Friday, part of Sunday, and all of Saturday. But we use language like that too in our world today if you really think about it. And you're like, it's just weird. Well, have you ever used the word literally and not meant literally? Like, I literally died. But you didn't literally die? Isn't it funny that the word literally is literally supposed to mean literally, but sometimes it can be used to mean not literally? It's kind of funny. Or have you ever used the phrase, I worked all day long, but maybe it was just 8 hours? It wasn't literally all day. It's just an expression that we use to convey a message that people in the use of idioms, we'd understand what people mean. Likewise, these gospel writers are not shocked whenever someone says 3 days and three nights, the third day. The fact is, we know that Jesus was crucified on Good Friday, which was part of Friday. He was there all day Saturday, and on Sunday at some point, he rose, which you can count all 3 days, which fit this 3-day framework that is being mentioned here.